Today's Tay Show will be on case 65 in the Book of Serenity. Case 65 is entitled Shushan's New Bride. Case, tut tut, show. Puff puff, whoosh whoosh, vague, confusing. Impossible to chew, hard to approach. Tell me, what story is this? Asked Shushan, what is Buddha? Shushan said, a new bride rides a donkey. A mother-in-law leads it. Verse, the new bride rides the donkey. The mother-in-law leads it. Their appearance and style are indeed natural. How laughable. The neighbor girls imitating a frown. To other people, it increases ugliness, does not make beauty. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to Zen. Everybody has been very deeply during the last sit, and thank you for that. You know, I don't have to tell you that it's been a challenging year. You know, it could have turned out much worse thanks to the election. We're in a new, we have a new leadership. But nevertheless, you know, even with that, this has been really challenging. You know, a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago at this time, we started sitting online because of the COVID outbreak. And we've been through a lot. I think when it's over, we'll definitely look back and realize how much we had to deal with. It's been a roller coaster, and it looks like the end may be in sight. We're hoping that's the case. I read every day the COVID news in the New York Times. And we're hoping that there isn't some new variant that's going to create a new set of problems. You know, hopefully, I was reading in one outlet, they said, actually, summer might be almost a normal summer, and that would be so wonderful. You know, we've been in our houses for the most part, or our apartments. Some people have been able to go to work, but a lot of people have been working from home. And that's challenging in itself. You know, I get up and I meditate. And then sometimes I will go for a run or get on an elliptical machine. And then I can easily spend 10 hours sitting in front of my computer on Zoom or grading papers. Then you get up and you can have dinner, and then you can come back and sit down at your computer again. So it's very challenging to be in a small space or to be in a house day after day, month after month. All of that's been true for most of us. No. And it's possible to get stale. It's possible to get burned out, especially with this weather, right? Not only are we cooped up all day, but, you know, it's been gray out there many, many days, rainy and gray or cold and gray. So, you know, it's sort of always the same in the house. And then you look out the window and it's always the same. It's snowy, it's gray, and you're doubly sort of confined. So, you know, all of this is what we've been coping with. And I have to say, you know, I was thinking how wonderful it would be to go into the city. I would love to just be able to get on the train and go into the city and go to the Met and maybe go to the the East Asian section of the Met and spend the day looking at all the amazing art they have, and then maybe go to a Thai restaurant or something. That would be like the perfect day, but that's not in the cards right now, you know, and it would just be wonderful to do that. So I think we're all struggling, and it's possible to get burned out. But you know, this koan is making a valuable point for us right now. With all we've been through, we can feel like we're worn out or we're worn down, and so this is the perfect koan. A monk asked Shushan, "What is Buddha?" Shushan said, "A new bride rides a donkey. The mother-in-law leads it." So this is, one way to think about this koan is like this, that this is experience guiding, youth, right? So the mother-in-law is, she's seen the world. She knows the world. She's seasoned. She maybe is a little bit skeptical. And the bride, this is a bride on the way to her husband. So the new bride is going to her her in-law's house, and the mother-in-law is leading her. So it's like a East Asian wedding ceremony. She's on the way to her new life, see? One way to understand the koan is she's a kid, right, as we would say. She doesn't know much. She's been living in her parents' house, and now she's going to go living in a strange house. And you know, she doesn't know much about the world. She's sort of guide, and maybe full of crazy dreams. She doesn't know what's coming, right? And so she's going to this new life. She's in transit to this new life, and the mother-in-law is leading her donkey, okay? So, one way to understand this koan is that, we have, when we're growing up, we do crazy things and we're very naive. And it's a good thing to have somebody with a little bit more experience guiding us. And that's definitely true, right? I mean, I've done some things that, definitely were crazy when I was young, and I didn't always have a wise older figure to offer me advice, I remember when I got out of college, I didn't have much money, and it was the 70s, so it was a different world than it is now. But at that time, a lot of young people would hitchhike. And I had a backpack, and I remember getting on the on-ramp to the interstate, sticking out my thumb and riding across the United States. And, sometimes I would get left in these places. I would get left in literally the middle of nowhere, like someplace in Montana. And it would just start pouring rain, And I remember a couple of times, I slept under under bridges on the interstate, right? So you have an overpass, and there's a, if you look at the overpass, there's a gradient, and then at the top is a little flat area. I've actually slept there in places like that. One time I went through Flagstaff, Arizona, and I actually slept in the rail yards. Years later, I was talking to somebody, and I said, yeah, I've been to Flagstaff. When I was hitchhiking, I slept in the rail yards. And the guy, it was like, oh, my God, are you crazy? You could have been really hurt. The lot of people hang out in the rail yards who are like criminals, and a lot of dangerous things happened there. He was astounded. I didn't know. I thought, oh, this looks like a nice place to pitch my tent, So, in retrospect, I realized that I think some things that were rash and maybe even crazy. I'm glad I didn't get hurt. I'm sorry I didn't have like a wise older person who could have said, you know, whatever you do, don't sleep in the rail yard in Flagstaff, Arizona. And sometimes I did meet people who were older and wiser on the road. I remember I had many situations where somebody would pick me up and they'd ask me about myself and take me to their home and serve, you know, give me dinner or take me to a restaurant and buy like a meal for me just to be nice. And a lot of people let me sleep on their living room floors or in their apartments. And those are wonderful memories, you know, and they would often like offer me wise advice, you know. I remember one time I was, when I was living in the Northwest, I had this fantasy that I was going to work in the lumber industry. In the Northwest in the 70s, there was still a big timber industry. And, you know, people would cut these trees down and you'd get them ready to be hauled out. And I had this romantic fantasy that I could wear a plaid shirt and be in the lumber industry. So I went to this recruiting office, and this woman looked at me, and she just shook her head. She said, "There's no way you can work here." She said, "You will be killed," because it's very dangerous. You know, people cutting trees. You know, the trees buck back at you. They fall on people. It's the most. I learned later, working in the forestry industry is the most dangerous job in the United States. Cutting trees down is the most dangerous occupation. So she looked at me and she just said, you know, first of all, you're about 100 pounds too thin. And she said, and you will be killed. And she said, there's no way you're going to work for this company. So then she looked at me and she said, "You don't have a son just like you. He doesn't have his act together." So she was a kindly, wise woman who was trying to protect me from getting hurt, right? So I'm so grateful to her. She was a bodhisattva. So one way to think about this koan is that, you know, we all start our lives out not knowing a lot and making like a lot of mistakes because we don't have people to guide us. And, you know, this is a situation where the young bride is going to her new in-law's home. She's starry-eyed and naive, and she could get into trouble. She could get on the way to her destination. Something could go wrong, you know. And so the mother-in-law is a wise figure who's guiding her in this transition from her old house to her new house. And that's definitely a certain. There's definitely a certain truth to that, right? So if you're working with this koan, you know, you might remember, say, people in your life who have helped you, mother-in-law figures, like, who have helped you in your life, who have, like the woman in the lumberyard who wouldn't hire me because she said I would be killed, or, you know, people who gave me meals on the road and offered me motherly advice or fatherly advice, you know. And so what, I remember once I was in a town of Española, New Mexico, and a policeman drove up when I was hitchhiking, and I thought he was going to give me a hard time. And he said, "Let me take you out of town because this is a dangerous spot." And he actually drove me to a place that was, he said, "This is a much safer place for you to hitchhike." So looking out for me, right? So definitely you might be moved by working on this koan, bring people who helped you in your life, who offered you wise guidance when you didn't know the ropes, right? When I came to Rutgers, the man who gave me my job spent like 3 weeks just orienting me to my job. And he had been doing the job so long, he was totally burned out. And he had a big desk in his office, and on the desk he had all of these unanswered memos. He had all this correspondence that had been directed to him that he hadn't replied to. And my orientation was just his peeling off a memo and lighting a cigarette and explaining to me what it was all about. It was something he hadn't answered or something replied to. He'd give a big sigh, like, oh, this is another headache I haven't taken care of. But at the end of 3 weeks, I really knew my job, you know. So I'm really indebted to him for showing me the ropes, another wise mother-in-law figure. So that's one way to approach this koan, but, you know, there's another way to approach it, which is a little, I would say, also true, you know. So when we think about koans, it's not the case that there's always like one right answer to a koan. You know, a koan is like taking you on a journey of discovery. And you're not going to use your discriminating mind. You're going to go sit down on the cushion and go into deep mushin. That's the koan on a deeper level, right? You're going to let your big mind present something to you. So in this case, you know, you can say there's really two parts to the koan. There's mother-in-law and there's new bride. And there's other koans that have two parts too, actually. You know, in this case, you could start with mother-in-law or you could start with new bride, you know, either way. And if you do one, you haven't really necessarily worked through the other aspect of the koan. So, you know, when a teacher gives you this, the teacher may say the turning phrase is new bride. But in this case, the teacher could say, which do you want to do, the mother-in-law or the new bride? Decide as you sit which one you want to work with. And you could do a mother-in-law. And as I said, you know, you might remember bad experiences you've had. Maybe if you've had a difficult experience with your, then you might, bad things might come up that you have to work through in your processing on the cushion. So maybe you didn't get along with your spouse's mother, and that was a bone of contention, you know, and maybe you felt wounded or rejected, and you might have to work through that. But at any rate, there's this other side to the koan, which is the new bride. And, you know, we might understand the new bride as the naive part of ourselves, right? The naive part of ourselves. You know, we've made so many mistakes. We've been so clueless sometimes, you know. And I certainly have in my life been utterly in the wrong place at the wrong time, especially when I was young, and utterly clueless. So working with this koan, I might remember times when I was just utterly clueless. I remember when I got to Rutgers, I invited some very distinguished professors to my house for dinner. And they were such nice people. They actually came to the dinner. And it was a total disaster. Everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And as it turns out, I later discovered that the two gentlemen I had invited actually didn't like each other at all. And they were totally nice to each other during the whole meal. It was like an potentially explosive situation. They were so kind to me. They didn't want to have a fight in my living room, right? So they were just very nice to each other. And of course, my idea was to make a souffle. And if you know me personally, you know I like to cook, and I had come up with this fantastic souffle recipe. And anyway, the eggs wouldn't stand up. So it was, I tried ice. It was just, the evening was like an unmitigated disaster, right? You know, and after it was over, later I talked to people, and they said, you invited those two people to the same party? You know, are you out of your mind? You know, it was just a naive person's mistake, right? So, you know, I've made lots of naive person's mistakes in my life. And sitting with this koan, you might think of all the times you were clueless and you didn't know the backstory, or you said exactly the wrong thing, or you did exactly the wrong thing. And you could say to yourself, oh, I'm so glad I'm not that clueless person anymore. I'm so glad I'm not that maladroit person anymore. Now I know the world. See, and that would be a reasonably acceptable answer, but you'd be missing something really important, you know, really important about yourself and about this koan. You know, there's a part of ourselves which we know very well, right? You know, there's a part of ourselves that we know pretty well. And, you know, this is the part of ourselves that we've discovered in living, however old you are, 28 years old, or 35 years old, or 55 years old, or 65 years old, or 75 years old, right? You know, so, you know, if somebody says, do you want to go to, you know whether you like Thai food or not. So if somebody says, do you want to go to a Thai restaurant? You've been to 20 Thai restaurants. You pretty much know how you're going to respond. Or if somebody says, hey, you know, would you like to go to Disney World? You know, you probably feel about Disney World, like not while I'm still alive or not I'm over my dead body or something. Or maybe you love Disney World, right? So there's a part of ourselves we know very well, right? And so, you know, we feel like this is who we really are. We feel who, you know, so I like Thai food. I like to jog. I like to hike. I'm a big outdoors person, right? So, you know, I feel like I know myself pretty well. I know that I would enjoy, if the COVID situation is over this summer, you know, my dream summer would be to fly out to Jackson Hole and hike into Teton Mountains. And I would stop at the Thai restaurant in Jackson Hole before I went up into the mountains. So that would be like my ideal thing. So I sort of... But actually, you know, that person is really not all there is to me. You know, there at the core of yourself, there's a stranger, you could say. You know, there's at the core of yourself, there's like this stranger. You know, we say in Zen that at the core of the mind, we say is Buddha mind or Buddha nature. Sometimes this is called the Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha. But, you know, another way to put it is at the core, it's like if your consciousness is a sphere, there's all these layers to the sphere. And the outer layer is like the one that says, oh, this afternoon I have to stop at the store and get some groceries before I go home. You know, I'm out of milk, right? And then there's another layer which is saying, you know, oh, I have to get that abstract in for the conference, right? That kind of thing. And as you go through these layers of the mind, you get to a layer, whenever we meditate, we go down into the sphere, right? The top layer is dog food, must get dog food. The next layer is, you know, thinking about some task you have to perform. Maybe you start thinking about how you're going to write that email, right? And then down below that, it's no longer like organized thoughts. It's like fragments of thoughts just flowing along like a stream of fragmented thoughts. And under that, there's like emotions and memories, right? And so these are like concentric spheres. And this is like a little model of your consciousness, right? And when at the center of the, as you go down into the sphere, you go through the different layers of the mind, you eventually get to a layer of the mind that's just blank. This is like mushin. So when we sit, we don't go straight down and stay at the bottom, so to speak. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you think about the dog food, and then you suddenly go down into a level of the mind where memories start coming up. And then you keep saying moo, or you watch your breath, and you go down a little deeper, and then the memories go away. And then your mind is very blank, but you hear ambient noises, and you stay in, as you go deeper and deeper into that blankness. Finally, your mind is like a blank screen or like a computer that's turned off, like the screen of a computer. So that's not the bottommost layer of the mind. that's the farthest we can go with our conscious awareness. That's like the layer of Mushin, you know. So there's a layer under Mushin, or there's something under Mushin, which is Buddha mind. Is eventually, at first it's experienced as dark, you know, dark and blank. But eventually it's experienced as bright, luminous. So, you know, at the center of your consciousness is this bright and luminous awareness, which is, you could say, the body of the Buddha, or Buddha mind, Dharmakaya. And, you know, this is unknowable. And unknowable. And, you know, we get there in Sesshin especially, but you can even get there on a Saturday if you do a lot of sitting, you know. You come in to sit and you're distressed, you know, something's happened to you during the week that causes you a lot of anxiety, or as you're going through your week, you know, something comes up that's been an old problem in your life. And you sit down on the cushion, you know, and you begin to watch the breath, and then all of this stuff comes up. You're working your way through the layers. And, you know, then that blank screen layer of the mind, right? And if you stay there, you begin to experience some relief. You know, the closer you get to that core consciousness, to like the stranger in yourself, it's like the more relief you feel. Actually, the closer you get to that consciousness and the longer you stay in that blank place, the more you let go of all this stuff. I hope I'm making some sense. But, you know, when we meditate, we're not just trying to calm the mind. We're not just trying to relax. You know, we're actually like peeling back the layers of the mind until we get to this place that's right on the edge of our luminous, enlightened mind, our Buddha mind. And, you know, the longer we stay in that place, the better we feel. You know, the better we feel. So, you know, you could come in on a Saturday, and, you know, if you got here at 8 o'clock, you know, the first two sits could have been torture. You know, maybe something happened during the weekend. You kept replaying those tape loops. And, you know, on the third sit, your mind begins to go quiet. You know, thoughts begin to recede, and you're in this blankness more and more. You know, and then I ring the bell, and people go to the bathroom, and you come back, and you just stay in that blankness. It's very purifying, you know, very, very liberating. And this is what happens to people at Sesshin in an even more profound way. You know, on the first day of Sesshin, you come to Sesshin, and all this stuff follows you to Sesshin. It's just uncanny. And you know, in the afternoon of day one, it can feel even more urgent, and things can bother you even more than before you arrive. You know, but when you stay in that blank place for a while, for hours on end, at Sesshin, you know, by day three, you know, everything has changed. It's like you've let go of all this stuff. Right? It's gone. And, you know, at the end of a long period of sitting, sometimes you get off the cushion and you go outside, and everything seems so fresh and alive, right? And it's like suddenly your mind is like clean and fresh. And, you know, you can hear things or see things so lively and so vibrant when you're in this state, right? You know, I've had many experiences where at the end of a Sesshin, I've just been doing something very routine, like running water in the sink or turning on a sprinkler outside. And it's like the sound of a sprinkler after 5 days of meditation. It's just like you can hear every drop hit every blade of grass. And it's so beautiful. It's just like unspeakably beautiful. And if you try to communicate it to somebody, you can say, oh, the sound of sprinklers, it's so beautiful. You know, they wouldn't necessarily understand what you're talking about because they haven't gone through this purification of the mind. But, you know, this happens to everybody who practices Zen. And actually, it's the opposite of what we might think. You know, it's the opposite of, like, the wise mother-in-law leading the naive to her husband's house. See, that's how we normally think about it. But actually, you know, actually, we all possess this, like, new bride consciousness. And we forget that we possess it. And we forget that it's there and that we can access it. You know, we get caught in our interminable mental habits, you know, and they can seem impossible to escape from, right? They can seem, sometimes, you know, we can get so into such ruts that it seems impossible that things could be different, right? And we can be so burned out, you know, maybe in our jobs or in our family situations. And, you know, it's like, oh, no, not another day of this, right? And, you know, all of that is just how we're greeting the moment. All of that is just that's the mother-in-law mind, right? I've been there, seen it all, done that. I'm wise to all of that. And, you know, if we live, so to speak, too much in the mother-in-law mind, and this is not a slam at real-world mother-in-laws, it's a symbol in the culture. If we live too much in the knowing mind, the mind that has all the answers, the mind that's stepped into all the minefields and knows where to avoid stepping, you know, we have something too in life, right? You know, that naivete is priceless. Right? The naivete is priceless. You know, so we lose that as we get older, and we can lose it very early in life, right? But it's always accessible to us, you know, if we know how to get there. And when we get there, everything is like the first day of our lives all over again. You know. So a lot of them, you know. This seems like learning the ropes, right? You know, you sit this way, you breathe this way, you know, do this, do that. And, you know, after I've been doing this for 40 some years, after 40 years of doing this, I know the ropes, right? I know how to sit, I know how to breathe. If you go to Sesshin a lot, you know, you learn, you become a seasoned practitioner of Sesshin. You know how to, like, husband your resources, you know, you realize, okay, it's afternoon, I'm going to take a nap because usually before dinner I'm totally wiped out, so you have a little nap and then you're not so wiped out before dinner, and after dinner you know to get a cup of tea because you get drowsy at the 9 o'clock sit. You learn the ropes. But, you know, it's easy in life to lose touch with the new bride part of ourselves because we get so good at learning the ropes. But a lot of Zen practice is learning how to get back in touch with that starry-eyed, empty-headed person we once were, right? And that we always are. And those moments in life when you feel totally trapped on the cushion, and, you know, after you sit all day or a couple days, you suddenly realize there's all these possibilities. Anything could happen. I can be a totally different person. You know, you can be a totally different person. And in fact, you know, that's what Zen practice is all about. You know, it's definitely the case that we can't necessarily be a totally different person overnight. But, you know, I'm a very different person than the person I was when I started doing Zen practice 40 years ago. You know, I would describe myself as mildly depressed 40 years ago. You know, I had some experiences that left me very unhappy. You know, some of them were my fault and some of them weren't my fault. And I started doing Zen, and, you know, right away I started to feel better. You know, it just like a couple of weeks of sitting, and I would go to Zen and I would come away. And, you know, nobody said to me for a long time, oh my gosh, you're a totally different person. You know, it wasn't like that. But little by little, my world changed, you know, and I became a person quite unlike the person I was when I started practicing. And, you know, you're sort of always the last one to know, to notice the change. But definitely after, like, you know, 5 or 6 years of Zen practice, people would say to me, you know, you just aren't the same person you were. So, you know, we just keep going back to that new bride consciousness. And that's what Zen practice, you know, that's the famous beginner's mind, right? You sit down on the cushion, you're working with these things that might be 50 years old, assuming you're older than 50, and, you know, they seem interminable and intractable problems you'll never work through. But, you know, you just keep going back to the new bride consciousness, and you get into this place in yourself that's bright and open, and, you know, even things that have hurt you terribly, you know, when you get into this consciousness, those things begin to be less and less important. And it's like one day you're just a child again, almost. So it's like being young again, having that optimism or having that openness to things, right? There's a wonderful movie. I'm sure most people here have never seen it. And it was actually it wasn't a wonderful movie. It was a pretty bad movie, now that I think about it. But it was called The Razor's Edge with Bill Murray. And Bill Murray, some of you might know, is a comedian who still around. He got his start on Saturday Night Live like 40 years ago. But in the movie, he plays a person who comes back from a Buddhist temple after a number of years there. And him is abjectly miserable. You know, the stock market has crashed. You know, and one of his best friends has lost everything in the crash, and he's totally debilitated by it. And, you know, everybody's miserable. And helping these people just in this most inconsequential ways. His presence, his ability to be in that mind, that new bride mind, it is liberating for everybody around him. They feel so boxed in. They've lost track of that part of themselves. And, you know, when everybody else is unable to break free, you know, he's living from that place. And, you know, it seems to me that's what Zen is all about. There's inside of ourselves, there's this new bride consciousness, this stranger. It has no birth, no birthday, and no death day. We never know it. It's unknowable, right? I know Kurt, but I don't know this stranger in myself. But the thing about it is it's always young. It's always fresh. It's always open. And, you know, when I encounter that stranger in myself, you know, I feel younger. It's like I'm younger. I'm more open. And so, you know, Zen practice is really about having a relationship with the new bride consciousness in yourself, place for that in your life, and then constantly going back to that place. You're going back to that place. So, you know, if you meet the new bride once, if you don't know how to get there, it's only somewhat helpful, right? So maybe you go on a vacation and you go to, you know, Costa Rica, and you feel like a new man or a new woman and your problems seem remote, that's wonderful. And I hope you have that experience. But, you know, you can get there even if you don't go to Costa Rica. And, you know, you can only go to Costa Rica so many times before it becomes routine, right? And not the new bride anymore. But in yourself, you can access that all the time. So you know, Zen practice, you could say, the Zen life is about having a relationship with the new bride consciousness in yourself. and actually like protecting it and looking out for it and taking care of it. And that means practicing often, coming to sit often, and, you know, replenishing yourself at that place, you know, making a habit of going to that place often. And it's like it's like two parts of your life coming together. And when they come together, you know, it's like a coin broken in two, and you find a coin and you put them together, and that's a whole coin, right? The part of you that has knowledge and experience is valuable too. But, you know, we get trapped by what we know and by how we've lived, and then it becomes very difficult to change. If you can get access to the new bride in yourself, you know, there's like this infinitely renewable energy that you can bring into your life, no matter how boxed in you feel or how trapped you feel. And you know, if you can get access to that, you know, your becomes, you know, I would say, you know, having done this for many, many years, you know, everything becomes, can be, you know, this wonderful adventure, you know, things that happen to you that seem at first, you know, threatening or frightening can become this wonderful opportunity, you know. I have been in a situation myself in my job where I'm looking at who are younger than myself, and they're now basically being trained to replace me in my job. But that way, you know, I've been doing my job for 36 years, and there are younger people who are now working under my direction who are really being trained to replace me. And I have to be honest with you, you know, when that started happening, I had very mixed feelings about it, because I've done my job for 36 years, and I have, you know, a sort of sense of possessiveness over these things that I've done all for decades and decades. And, you know, at first it was hard for me to give up these things that I've done that really are part of my world, part of myself. You know, I define myself in terms of what I can do in a lot of ways. And, you know, suddenly these young people come in and they can do them better than I can and faster than I can. And, you know, I did go through a period in the last couple of years where I felt that I was going to be less valuable as a person. I suddenly realized, why am I fighting this? You know, I've done this job for, you know, after sitting on the cushion for a while, you know, I suddenly realized, why am I fighting this? There's so many things I can do instead of these things. And it really did, you know, it was like, for a while, I felt like I was losing all of these things that defined who I was, you know. So, you know, I sit on these committees and everybody turns and says, well, what do you think, Kurt? You know, now I'm not on those committees. Other people are on those committees. You know, my younger replacements are on those committees. You know, and for a while that felt very, very like a loss, right? Like threatening. But, you know, all of a sudden I realized I have all of this freedom to do other things, things that I've wanted to do in my life, like more writing, I've done more research, all this stuff that I have never had time to do. Suddenly I realize I have all these opportunities. And, you know, in some ways I feel like I'm just beginning my career again. You know, I have this opportunity now to do totally new things. It's a little nerve-wracking. I'm a little bit like a bride going to her new husband's house. What to expect, but there's all this possibility. So, you know, whether you're 65 years old or you're 25 years old, you know, we all have, I think, this same mentality, right? You know, we grab onto things that are part of who we are and we define ourselves in those ways. But you know, you can be a totally different person if you and in the best possible way. You can be creative with your life if you're not afraid of change. And there's a part of you that loves change, that loves not knowing. And that's the part that we have to make contact with when we sit. And you know, that's what koan training is all about. You know, every koan feels a little bit sometimes like losing control, right? Losing, being replaced or whatever you're afraid of. But then you realize, you know, I thought this was a dead end, but now I realize this is a door into something, you know, quite wonderful. A monk asked Shushan, "What is Buddha?" Shushan said, "A new bride rides a donkey, the mother-in-law leads it." So, you know, that's sort of all of us. We're the mother-in-law and we're the daughter. And, you know, to live the Zen life is to take care of your new bride consciousness and make a place for it in your life. You know, you need your worldly wisdom. You need the knowledge you have acquired in however many years you've lived, but you also need access to that new bride consciousness, which is always new and always fresh. Right? It's always naive, always naive. How wonderful to be naive. How wonderful. First, the new bride rides the donkey, the mother-in-law leads it. Their appearance and style are indeed natural. It's like the two together, right, is a proper way to live. How laughable, the neighbor girls imitating a frown. To other people, it increases ugliness, does not make beauty. So, you know, those people are unable, the people who are laughing and pretending to frown, they're unable to understand, you know, the power of the new bride consciousness. So they're passing, they're trapped in their judgments, but we don't have to be. You know, every moment is new moment if we know how to access it. And so, you know, you came here today to practice the great way and to access the new bride consciousness in yourself. And I hope you keep doing that for as long as you're alive.